We need to go 100% renewable energy ASAP, but...
The shocking thing about the grid is that it stands in the way of us accomplishing that. So there's a lot of push and there's a lot of talk about how we can make a better world, and we have the machines. We can make more electricity than we need with renewables. That's not the problem. The problem is that the way that the grid is structured is actually precisely to run very, very well with the stuff that we get out of the ground. So there's a reimagination of the grid that needs to then get sort of sunk down into the infrastructure itself in order for us to continue forward with the dream of a less polluting way of running our planet.
That's Gretchen Bakke. We spend the hour talking with her about her terrific new book, The Grid: The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. We also tell you about a news-breaking interview posted on our website. It's about a new report examining troubling red flags in the election results of the Florida Democratic primary. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. There's no question that we need to transition fast to 100% renewable energy if we're to escape the worst consequences of climate change. There's also no question that such a transition would be great for our faltering economy, creating millions of jobs here at home and around the world. But getting there isn't easy. It's not just the vast power of the fossil fuel industry that's slowing us down. It's the dead weight of a 19th century electrical grid that's woefully unsuited to a 21st century clean energy system. My guest, Gretchen Bakke, tells the whole fascinating story of how that happened, what it means for us now, and how we can break free of the grid's chains in her new book, The Grid. I confess, when I first saw the title, I thought I was in for several hundred pages of informative but dull reading. But boy, was I wrong. Bakke is a cultural anthropologist. On her website, she describes herself as, quote, interested in what people do when the systems they rely upon stop working. And the subtitle of her book, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future, reflects on her perspective on the grid as a cultural phenomenon, embodying the power relationships of our society as much as the engineering of power transmission. Bakke even makes the engineering part gripping reading, showing why the nature of electricity itself sets the parameters of how society solves the problem of generating and storing power. But how we operate within those parameters is the crux of Bakke's story, and that's entirely up to us as a society. From smart grids to microgrids, and even the nanogrid you might put on your roof, Bakke shows that we have choices to break free from the crumbling monster that brings us our power today. Well, Gretchen Bakke, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me.
A central theme of your book, The Grid, is how the needs of consumers are at odds with the needs of the vested interests that have so far run our electrical system. Not really the fault of the consumers, but the needs of a changing technology, a changing world. Talk a little bit about that.
I would say in some ways it's also not really the fault of the people who run the electricity system, but that the way that the system was built up over time, in part to make profit, but in part to just make it make sense so that electricity wouldn't just be for a few people as it was in the 1880s and early 1890s, but could become a more public source of light and power, sort of a grander undertaking. The way that that system developed, there was a lot of push and pull always between people who wanted some sort of control over sort of a smaller world, which at that time was called a private plant, and now it looks a lot like having a diesel generator or having solar panels, and people who wanted to have a system that had a much broader sort of expanse and that they could make more money off of. And that is what's interesting about the present moment to me is that that was very present in the 1880s and 1890s, that push and pull, and it's very present now, but for most of the 20th century it was not present. It was really presumed that there would be a big service provider and it would give the same quality electricity to everybody at something like a fair price, an affordable price. And that's kind of faded away with the renewables, as renewables have come in and really shaken up the system. One of the things that has happened with that shaking is that smaller private systems have suddenly leapt forward again as something people are interested in.
Before we go more deeply into that point, because it's a crucial one in this book, The Grid, is to note that already what you've talked about is a system that's not just a technological system, but much more than that. How is it not just a technological system?
The first thing is that I'm an anthropologist, and I think a lot of people ask, what is an anthropologist doing studying the grid? There's this idea that you look up and there's the wires. Oh, there's the grid. That's something that doesn't concern us as people. It supports us, but it's out there in the, strange infrastructures that we don't need to worry about, everyday people don't need to worry about. And the reason that I got into the project is because I grew up on the Oregon coast, and I saw, going back to visit my parents, that strangely over the early 2000s, people who were townspeople, kind of non-radical people, were getting frustrated enough with their power going out that they were starting to take kind of radical action. They were organizing, they were having conversations, they were figuring out ways to create heat and light that meant that they didn't rely on their utility. And that, to me, was the first crack, where I saw, this is a social thing. There's some sort of social movement going on here. And that has only grown with time, since the sort of first inklings. And then as I began to trace the grid backwards into its history, I realized that it's always been that way. And that, in fact, even though electricity systems look similar to ours, in Europe especially, a little bit in Korea, which has a very, very good electric grid, there are peculiarities to the American system that arise out of cultural values that we have in the particular history of sort of late 19th century, full 20th century, and then contemporary America. So it is a social system. It is us that are pushing and pulling and making this thing work the way it does, and especially the idea that you should always be able to make money off of everything. That has had a great impact on the form of our grid, the form, the organization, and the workings of it. And that's something you don't necessarily see in power systems and other places.
And so in other places, it's more of a public good, you're saying, rather than being driven by the need to make a profit?
Well, in the U.S., it's also a public good, in part because Roosevelt made that happen. It was understood during the Great Depression that that uplift in some way depended upon universal electrification. In the same way that you needed to have sewer systems for everybody, you needed to have good water for everybody, the electricity was just becoming important enough at that time just to studying, for example. The sun goes down and you can't do homework. You can't read, not for very long. So as rural people were becoming less farmers or were given the chance for a different kind of social mobility, electricity was a big part of that. So there is a social idea at the base that everybody in America should have electricity, and it's not something that's a sort of have and have not. But nevertheless, given that, somebody should also be able to make money off of it. So that's the thing that's tacked on. And the other places that have state monopolies on the electrical system, there is still some profit made, but it isn't this explicit sense of having stockholders, for example. I often use this example of when you play Monopoly, right? The first thing that you do, if you've played it a lot, is buy all the railroads and buy all the utilities, because no matter what happens, whenever anyone lands on it, you're going to make a return. And that was how it was structured. It was actually built that way from the 1920s forward.
What you're talking about is really leads to another central discussion in the book that relates to this, and that is how problematic is the integration of renewables into it, precisely around this social relationship of profit-making.
Yeah, and it's also, so I will talk about that for sure, but it's also that there's a promise to renewables. There's a way in which we imagine that the world can be made a better place if we can leave the stuff in the ground. There's a leave it in the ground movement. So leave the coal in the ground, leave the plutonium in the ground, leave the natural gas in the ground, leave the oil in the ground, and make power otherwise. And some of that has to do with global warming, and some of that has to do with the environmental movement more generally. And the shocking thing about the grid is that it stands in the way of us accomplishing that. So there's a lot of push and there's a lot of talk about how we can make a better world, and we have the machines. We can make more electricity than we need with renewables. That's not the problem. Even with current technology, we can do that. The problem is that the way that the grid is structured is actually precisely to run very, very well with the stuff that we get out of the ground. So there's a reimagination of the grid that needs to then get sort of sunk down into the infrastructure itself in order for us to continue forward with the dream of a less polluting way of running our planet.
So that's both a technological question as well as a social one. I wonder if you could tackle both sides of it. And technologically, what is the problem? How do renewables pose a problem for the grid as it's structured right now? We'll start with that, and then we'll talk about how they pose a problem for the profit-making enterprise.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, they don't quite pose a problem for the profit-making enterprise, but they make profit for different people. So that's always a shakeup, right? When there's a system in place, and suddenly there's new people who can make money off of it, and the old people aren't making money off of it. So the thing that is most surprising to people is that we don't really have an effective way to store electricity, not at a grand scale. And by store, I mean to take excess electricity and put it to the side, and then draw upon it later when we need that excess electricity. And since electricity is produced and used essentially within the same second, the production and the use need to be balanced with one another in order for the system itself to work. So if you turn on your porch light, there's a little bit more electricity somewhere in some power plant that has to be made in order to make sure that that light goes on. In general, there's a kind of pattern to the way that people use electricity that allows for planning for how much electricity is made. So we know that people use a lot more at 5 p.m. when they're all coming home, so the office buildings are still turned on and the houses are turned on and people are opening and closing their fridges and making dinner and doing laundry and turning up their air conditioners and all of these electricity-using things. And that can be accounted for at the power plant. So power plants are turned up a little bit every day at that time. The problem with renewables is that though they're somewhat predictable, you know normally when the wind is going to blow hard because it's coming from somewhere. So you watch it blow hard across a geography, and then when it hits the wind farm, you know that it's going to produce more electricity. But that might not happen at the same time that electricity is needed. So that's the disconnect. And with coal and with nuclear, with hydroelectric power, with natural gas, it's us, or you could say the utilities, the people who manage the power plants, who decide when to make more electricity. With sun and the wind, it's not us that decide that. It's the sun and the wind that decide it. And since there's nothing really in place that alters how or when people use electricity, there's this grand imbalance based upon that. And there's ways to push at it. Again, this is the American story, is that the grid was designed in such a way that we could use as much power as we wanted, always. Like, this was the idea. We would always be able to afford it, and we would always have enough available. So no matter what happened, we could just make more electricity. And in a way, renewables, they make that a more difficult project. And you see this in Texas. Texas is one of the utilities is giving away electricity at night because they have all this wind power in Texas. Not the greatest percentage. Iowa has the greatest percentage, but the actual kilowatt hours of possible production in Texas is the highest. And a lot of that wind blows at night when no one uses electricity. And so Texas has said in these sort of first tentative steps in trying to change how people are using electricity, they've said, one of the utilities has said, well, we'll give it away after 9 p.m. And so what you get is this sort of beautiful dance, you could imagine it, of at 9 p.m., people in Texas stand up from wherever they are, and they walk over, and they turn on their dishwasher, and they turn on their clothes washer, and they program their hot water heater to heat up at that point, and all of that electricity is free for them. But you see the grid is actually moving human beings. And what will happen, probably, as we try to push forward with more and more renewables, and we're also pushing forward on trying to figure out ways to store it, is that some of that will be automated so that you can program your dishwasher to know when to turn on. So you don't have to get up and do it.
The problem is, as you say, one of the problems is that you can't store the power for when it is most needed. But another problem is that renewables often supply too much. And let's be clear, you as well as I, and probably most of our listeners, are fully in favor of renewables, because if we don't, we're kind of sunk. We don't survive on this planet. So it's not really anti-renewable as more this is a problem we need to solve. But talk about how, you know, supplying too much energy is also a problem for the utilities. And that also,
it's certainly not, I certainly don't mean to sound anti-renewable in the least. It's just that there's sort of this point at which renewables sort of seem to get stuck. And people are like, why aren't we making more than 35% of our electricity from renewables? You know, we have enough wind, we have enough sun, why not? And it's that point at which the answer to why not is because the grid isn't designed the right way. It's not up to the task. And yes, and you're exactly right that sometimes that not being up to the task is that there's simply too much. The wind can blow so hard in certain places that there isn't the line capacity to move all of that electricity to market. I think the other thing is that the 1970s kind of gave us this idea about energy that shortage was what we needed to be attentive to. And even then, there was a problem of excess electricity at night. Coal-burning power plants, they produce too much electricity at night. So prices were very, very cheap. A lot of manufacturers ran at night. My husband at one point was working on a wind tunnel, and they were required to run at night because they used so much electricity to run the wind tunnel. So he would get up and go to work at 11 p.m. every night because that's when they could afford to do it. So the excess isn't necessarily a new problem, but it's a new problem in the kind of the quantity or the surprisingness of when it comes. So at noon in Phoenix, you have too much electricity because there's so much solar power.
And how
so what do you do with it? It has to get used. And I think that's the strange piece is you can't just make electricity and then sort of not, you can't fill up a bucket with it, right? You have to use it. You have to find someone to use it. And how do you do that? Who do you call? You know, it's noon, we need you to use more electricity. Okay, now it's 5 p.m., we need you to use less.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with cultural anthropologist Gretchen Bakke about her book, The Grid. Now, this problem is very much because of the grid, i.e. a centralized system. You just mentioned the 1970s. Right at that point, something happened. The Public Utilities Regulatory Policies Act in California began to break and I'm not sure anybody foresaw this, it wasn't part of the intention, but began to break the monopoly power. Talk about PURPA, that act, and the first wind energy revolution.
Yeah, so it was actually national. It was part of Carter's Energy Policy Act, and it was a little tiny piece of it. It was a sort of a sub-clause of a sub-bill of this act that essentially said that very small electricity producers who could prove that they could make electricity for less money than the utility was making it, and which turned out to be a giant problem, the proving of it, not the doing of it, but the proving of it, the utilities would have to buy that electricity and move it to market. And previous to that, since the 1910s, utilities had essentially been monopolies, and they were vertically integrated companies, which meant they made the power, they moved the power, and they billed you for the power. So it was all under their control. And so this is a tiny thing that suddenly on the East Coast, largely cogeneration plants, which are big hot factories essentially that can just use their waste heat to generate electricity, they could always do it for cheaper than the utility was producing it because it was a secondary process. They weren't building a factory to make electricity. They just had the heat around, so why not use it to make power? And the West Coast, what happened, and in California especially, was this jump to renewables. And the stories are wonderful. I would recommend anybody to just sort of go to California and talk to people about the 1970s because they're just amazing what was happening. So there were many small dams, river dams, that were refurbished. Many of them had been there, but they were refurbished and started producing this sort of tiny amount of electricity. And then wind power came into vogue. And sort of aging hippies, at that point sort of, I guess they're aging hippies now, but honest-to-goodness hippies that had, many of them had been, they were draft dodgers, but who had worked on helicopters before the Vietnam War and had decided they didn't want to go to that war. They said, we know how the wind works. We know how rotors work. We know how blades work. We can build these electricity machines that produce electrons from the air. And they went about creating prototypes and selling those, and there were some tax breaks put into place that were tended ended up being sort of foolhardy, but brilliant also at the time. And these machines just started going up, and Wall Street got interested in it, and people were investing in them. And they didn't actually work very well, but that kind of didn't matter. They worked well enough to 1 year, and I believe in the very early 1980s, to produce the equivalent amount of electricity as San Francisco used that year. And that was just a coup. Wow. That was when it was possible to say renewables are not some sort of slapdash thing. They're not fly by night, I guess. We can actually make our power without polluting, and we can do it for cheaper than the utilities can do it by using coal. So slowly, both the technology and the idea grew during the Reagan years, when no one was paying that much attention, grew to fruition.
And in doing so, it broke the monopoly model. It also broke the connection, I guess, between utilities as the producers of power and the distributors of power. Is that
exactly
correct?
And with deregulation, which was not deregulation in the utilities in the electrical sector, it was sort of a re-regulation with an act in 1992 that took quite a while to become law, but it was passed in 1992, that essentially divorced generation, so how you make electricity, from transmission and billing. And so in most of the country, the utilities had to sell their plants. Some utilities still managed power plants, but for the most part, they had to sell them to private entities, often investment firms, buying them and running them. And it also meant that suddenly you could make a buck making electricity. So it wasn't just these tiny producers anymore. Big corporations, especially corporations from Europe who had been running wind and solar in Spain and in Denmark, came over and started just building wind farms where it was windy, which is precisely the right thing to have done. But those wind farms weren't part of this vertically integrated vision. It was, I'll make a wind farm where it's windy, I'll harvest the most of this wind, I'll produce the most electrons, I'll make the most money, but there aren't necessarily people where it's windy. That's the Iowa problem. Iowa produces 40% of its power by the wind. It's phenomenal. But there's not enough people to use it. Wyoming, the Dakotas, the Panhandle, the Columbia River Gorge, there are these places where it's very, very windy, where it's the right place to build a wind farm, but the wires that run out to those sites are not necessarily robust enough to deal with all that wind or to move it to market. And the people who build generation, they don't care about the wires because the wires are not their problem. The wires are the problem of the utilities. And balancing all of the renewable power that comes into the grid is the problem of a balancing authority, which is sometimes a utility and sometimes something else. So these things have been divorced in law, but electricity doesn't care about the law. It still works the same way. It's still an instantaneous thing that you make it and it needs to get used. And that's become, again, there's this sort of critical edge where the wires plug into generation and where the wires plug into use, that there's kind of a breakdown at each of these junctures as the grid gets cut up into pieces in law and in mind. So, again, it's possible to make money in ways that it hadn't been possible before. And then the Internet just exploded that. Like, so that was already happening. And then the Internet came along, and it was possible to trade electricity in real time. And that suddenly people were buying electricity cheaply in one place and moving it halfway across the country to sell it dearly in another. And the lines were getting overburdened and shorting out. And, you know, crazy stuff started happening, including the 2003 blackout was a product of that sort of ebullient moment of profiteering on long distance, called long distance wheeling.
Yeah, and all these forces, both technological change, social change, regulatory change, have meant that in a way the grid is like, has become, infrastructurally speaking, a kind of orphan, that the upkeep of the grid has become problematic, and that also was something that underlay this 2003 blackout. I wonder if you could use that case to explain to us these trends and what they mean.
Yeah, I think orphan is actually a really good metaphor for it, because there's so many people charged with different pieces of its care, but it's too complicated to understand or to hold the whole thing in mind all at once. And so it is sort of necessarily divided up in one way or in another way. And that means that there's always loopholes. There's always sort of blind spots or darknesses that get overlooked. So what happened in the 2003 blackout was essentially there were three trees that were overgrown. And this tree trimming is a place where utilities, it's not enforced by anybody. So you have to trim back the trees, because if they touch the wires or even get very close to the wires, they can short the wires out. And the same thing with vines. You have to somehow maintain them away. There's just a clearance level. You have to keep them down. And America is full of trees. So especially rural parts of America, it's very, very difficult. It's a lot of upkeep, and it's very difficult for them to do on private property, and it's expensive. And so what began to happen after this 1992 Act passed into law, in the early 2000s when it actually made its way all the way through the Supreme Court and became law, is that many of the utilities, started cutting back how often they trim trees. And there's a wonderful case in California where there's like hundreds of little fires that are started, and then one very big fire. And PG&E is taken to court in an old saloon called the Boozy Rouge. And the county, Nevada County, California, wins, and it's this tiny. This PG&E has more employees than Nevada County has people. It was a very kind of startling trial in the fact that PG&E lost. And we see the same thing in Ohio, which is where the 2003 blackout started. The basic maintenance of the grid fell from year to year, and also tree cutting. It went from a 3-year schedule to a 5-year schedule, and there were, like I said, three different trees that made contacts with wires that started that blackout, and all of them were at least 10 years taller than they should have been. So wires, when it's quite a hot day, even if they're not overburdened, they sag. Metal just stretches when it's hot, and so they sag down. So it's always risky in the summer when there's a lot of electricity being used and it's quite hot. So when you see the wires when you're driving and you see sometimes they seem like they're sagging very low, that's just because metal is stretchy, and the heat is what makes it stretch or contract. And so one wire arced, and it exploded a tree that was just next to it, and that wire shorted out. Then another wire did that, high-voltage wires, and then another one did it. And there's a lot of duplication of sort of capacity on the grid, but there's not so much that you can take out three fairly big wires and have it still be working well. But that was not the blackout. The blackout came when wires began shutting themselves down automatically, sort of self-protectively. They have this essentially a fuse box, like a fuse box in the house. And when conditions are not right, when there's more electricity traveling or current and voltage are not aligned quite properly, the equivalent of a fuse box will break and the wires will be taken out of the system. That means they still work, but they're not doing anything right then. And all of this was going on, and there was a computer bug in the control room of First Energy. That was the utility that was running that area of Ohio. They had a computer bug that essentially meant that their alarms, their screens weren't refreshing very quickly, and there were no alarms going off. So they didn't know. And it seems so simple these things that a couple of tall trees and a computer bug could actually black out the entire East Coast. It seems impossible. But the reason that it was possible, it wasn't just that the utilities were cutting back on maintenance and tree cutting. It wasn't just that there was a computer bug. There's always computer bugs. It was that underlying that there were these changes to the system, to how much electricity was moving on the system, to there's a way in which voltage is sort of buoyed up, and there are power plants that are designed to do that work, but you can't sell their output. It's called a VAR. And so after electricity became a commodity, which is what happened in the early 2000s, nobody wanted to buy these VARs because you couldn't resell them. And so those dropped way down. So there was all this sort of all of these different factors leading to instability system-wide. And then you get a couple of things, a couple of trees, a computer bug, and boom, there's a blackout.
So you're always going to have a couple of trees, or you're going to have squirrels gnawing on the wires, or even in one case that you talked about, a young eagle found out that he actually was not able to carry the deer that he just killed in the air.
I mean, the West is full of hysterical stories like that. There was another eagle who figured out he could kill snakes. He actually figured out he could kill snakes by dropping them on wires. So he would, like, pick up the snake, drop it on the wire, black out that section of thing, eat the snake, do it to the next wire over. So, I mean, there's always going to be these things, especially in a place as big as the U.S. If you're going to have a big grid, you're going to have, I see a squirrel right now, right in front of my face, there's a squirrel. You're always going to have squirrels. You're always going to have trees. You're always going to have smart wildlife. You're always going to have people stripping copper, which has a very high resale value, out of substations, for example, or just stealing it off the backs of vans. The idea is, and this is from transportation, from air transportation, is that it's called the Swiss cheese model of industrial accidents. And the idea is there's always holes in the Swiss cheese. But you need to devise a system where there's no one, they don't align. So those holes never run all the way through, because it's only when they run all the way through that you get a blackout or an airplane crash or something like that. Because you can't actually control all of those. You can't control the squirrels.
Gretchen Bakke, author of The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. Stay tuned for more talk about the grid and how to transform it after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with cultural anthropologist Gretchen Bakke, talking about her book, The Grid. Before the break, we're talking about how the huge blackout of August 2003 happened. Let's pick up the thread where we left off. So how would the grid have to have been different for 2003, the blackout, to not have happened?
That's a very good question. I think that the damage that was done there was a misunderstanding of electricity as a commodity. And so as the internet rose, it started to be thinkable that you could trade it in the way that you could trade anything else. And the problem with electricity is because you can never store it, because you can't stockpile it, because you have to use it when you make it, it isn't a commodity like anything else. And I think that that misunderstanding that was made into law was actually the root cause of the problem. And so much of what I feel like I'm pushing for in the book, and then also in talking when I'm talking with people like you, is to try to think with electricity, because it's the only thing of its type. You know, it's not a box of pineapples, which aren't good forever, but they're good for a while. And we know how to treat natural gas. We know how to put it aside. We know how to select between different qualities of certain kinds of commodities. But electricity, it just doesn't work like that. And there is a big push now, which I mentioned before, towards figuring out ways to store it so that it will work more like a regular commodity. And that's one set of reactions to help make the grid more stable, is if we are going to treat it as a commodity in law, and if we're going to treat it as a commodity in business practice, then let's at least make it act like a commodity. And that's what some sort of good storage system would allow for. But there are other ways forward. There are other ways to reinvent a grid that works with renewables, that doesn't just take that that particular view of making electricity like everything else that we know.
And yet, some of those are getting quite a bit of pushback. In fact, we've been talking about the monopoly, centralized, big power plant model of the grid, but there's microgrids as well, which I'd like to get back to, but let's just go down to the level of the individual homeowner, the so-called nano-grid. I do remember the 70s when there were plenty of people going off-grid, and they were using huge banks of batteries to do that. We've got better batteries now, but they're still not really ready for prime time to encourage people to disengage from the grid. But, for example, Hawaii is, we have other systems now. People are leasing solar panels. It's extremely popular in my area here in Long Island. But Hawaii is now refusing to honor further connections to the grid by homeowners. And in other places, people who put solar panels on the roof are being charged by utility companies just to have access to the grid. So explain kind of that landscape and the problems with it.
Yeah, so solar is actually the really interesting phenomenon right now because people like them. People like solar panels. They're quite affordable. And there are systems in place increasingly to make it possible to actually produce your own power for yourself. And that's something Elon Musk just released. He had released a battery before that would allow for some storage, but he has released a new one that would actually allow you to run your house without the big grid. So things are moving in that direction. Plus, they're very sexy, his batteries. It's not the old car batteries that we had in the 1970s where you had a garage full of these sort of acid leaky things. It's like this shiny, it looks like a giant, like it's been painted with fingernail polish, and you can put an extra hot water heater. And so there's a kind of up-to-dateness now to that path. But for the moment, the way that solar power works is that people with solar panels on their roofs, they aren't using that power. And I think that I've talked with several people who thought about getting solar panels and didn't realize that that was how it worked, that it's not for you. It's for the utility. You're making power for the utility. You're selling your solar power to them, and you're buying your electricity from them. It's just that the meter runs backwards when you're putting solar power into the grid, and it runs forward when you're pulling it out from the grid. And the reason for that, up till now, is that people who have solar panels can't make electricity at night for themselves. So they need to use the grid. And normally what people then do is they lease enough solar power panels so that they can essentially zero out their utility bill. And I find this very interesting because what it says is that customers, it's not that they're so invested in solar power as a way to sort of make a better world. They're invested in not getting a bill from their utility anymore because those bills, they don't make any sense. And if you put up solar panels and you get a lease or you buy them, you're essentially paying a mortgage on them, and those bills do make sense. You know how much you have to pay every month. If people were putting up solar panels in a way to sort of support the greening of the grid or renewable energy more generally, you would never see a rooftop with just four panels on it. You would see every roof would be coated completely.
Yeah, but I tried to do this in my home here after Hurricane Sandy. We were out of power for 5 days here. And what I was shocked to find out were a couple of things. One was that there was no provision for me to decouple from the grid during storms like Sandy. So there was no way that I could, even if I bought the Powerwall battery from Tesla, that I could actually supply my own power. The installers would not put on any kind of a switch.
Exactly. And so if you have solar panels, you black out with everybody else. You're essentially part of the grid. It looks like a small power system, but you are not in any way unlinked from it.
And that was a deal breaker for me. The other thing was that they would not allow me to put on any more solar power on my roof than I was already using. I don't have air conditioning at this point, but I'd like to put it in. But I can't put it in. I could put it in, but it'd be very expensive. I'd have to pay a lot more in my electricity bill, but I couldn't anticipate that cost in the number of solar panels I could put on my roof. It made no sense.
And all of these things. So I know many people who've gotten through this whole process exactly like you and then gotten a diesel generator.
Yeah, well,
because a diesel generator does allow you to run your electricity for yourself in a power outage. But it's just, I mean, it's just, you look at these as how this is playing out home by home by home, and people are so frustrated. Mm-hmm. And that frustration is running up against an older business model. That's what it is. The utilities don't have a way to, I mean, there's two things I have to say, but one is that the utilities don't have a way to make money if you don't buy electricity from them. And they're paying you for your electricity. They're not paying the wholesale rate. They're paying the retail rate, which means the electricity that they're buying from home solar or home solar systems, they're paying a much higher amount of money for it than for electricity they would make in a wind farm or in a, that they would buy from a wind farm or they would buy from a coal-burning power plant, for example. So there's a problem there. And then the technological problem is that when there's a blackout, the linemen need to know that there's no electricity on the lines. And I assume that this must be an easy fix, because if you have a diesel generator, you have electricity in your house, but you don't have, that electricity is not going out onto the lines. But with solar panels right now, that the electricity does leave the house and go into the lines, and it needs to not electrocute the linemen. So that is something that putting in some sort of blockage and designing the house, and that's where you start to talk about a nanogrid, the systems within the house need to then be redesigned to run on the solar power you're making, not on the power that the grid is making. Mm-hmm. So it's a bigger technological problem than it seems like it would be from the outset. But that does not mean that there aren't a lot of people who would really like to have it. I mean, I think if people who are putting in solar panels could say, with this, we give you some kind of storage, and we give you some sort of system that allows your house to run on all of the electricity that you're making as a tiny grid, which means it's balanced unto itself. And we make sure that none of that electricity is leaving, and thus a danger to the linemen working on the grid. I think people would adopt that.
In a heartbeat,
even if it was somewhat more expensive. And that's why when we talk about a nanogrid, it's not quite the same thing as saying getting off the grid. It's a thing which can island itself, that can become a little electricity island, and that can then connect into the big grid when the big grid is working. So it feeds into and takes back from the big grid, which is now often called the macro grid, when everything is going well. And when things are not going well, it disconnects from that macro grid, and it runs on its own. And what, again, came after Hurricane Sandy is New Jersey, in fact, understood. I don't know why New Jersey, but New Jersey understood that they actually had a lot more misery after Sandy, because all of these systems with home solar power couldn't serve as warming houses or safe houses for the communities that were around them. So that you could have a place that did have light, that did have heat, where people could charge their phones. And now the New Jersey Transit system is actually building, it's called a microgrid, so it's bigger than a nanogrid. It needs to include several ways of making electricity and also several different meters or several different draws on that electricity. But they're making one out of the transit system with the idea that train stations then can serve in a pinch. So you can get on a train, even an electric train, and you can get out of a disaster zone. You can stay warm if it's wintertime. You can charge your electronics. All of these things that people really needed during Hurricane Sandy, even if you still were out of power, just to have a neighbor that had power, or to have a school that had power, or to have a hospital that had power, every place that had these microgrids, they became real safe havens during that storm. And I think a lot of the East was convinced that that was the right way to go. But it's not off the grid. It's not this, like, independence, we're not a part of the big story anymore, we're on our own. It's a tiny grid that can link and unlink to the big grid, kind of as circumstances dictate.
Right, and I actually live in a place like that in East Hampton, New York, which, by the way, has pledged to go 100% renewable by 2020.
Wow.
Yeah, and is well on its way to doing that. It had at least one microgrid, I know, because I charged my phone up at the library and spent most of my time there during Sandy, the aftermath of Sandy, and they're planning on building a number of more microgrids. So how does a microgrid fit into the transition from the older way of running the grid, and by the way, we haven't even talked about the utility death spiral, to the new grid. Can it smooth the transition?
Well, I think what microgrids and nanogrids, there aren't really effectively nanogrids right now. There's very few of them, but there's a lot of microgrids popping up. And I think effectively what that allows for is for trials with technology. So how can you make a little thing? SUNY Stony Brook was one of the great examples, which I believe is near you, where they had a microgrid, and I think they lost power for an hour during Sandy. And they moved students into their dorms. It was really a safe haven. So with each time a microgrid is built, there's a lot of experimentation about how to make sure it's stable, both when it's connected to the big grid and feeding into it and drawing down from it, and also when it's disconnected. And as these sort of, I think Connecticut is building 25, New York has even more of them, as these begin to proliferate and interact with each other, that's where you might actually see the texture of the big grid shift to microgrids abutting microgrids. So that instead of one giant system that is fed by all of these power generators and is drawn down by all of the machines that with millions and millions of machines that we now plug into it, you have these little bubbles that kind of stick to each other, sort of like bubbles in the bath. So you have these bubbles that abut each other, and those bubbles actually combine to form the big grid. They become the substance of the big grid. And this idea has become much more popular in the East than in the West. And I think part of that is a result of Sandy, and part of that is just about population density. There are different ideas that are happening in Nevada and Utah and the Dakotas and even the rural parts of California, Idaho, because there's no people there. So there's a lot of resources. There's a lot of solar. There's a lot of wind, but there's no people. And so microgrids are less popular there than they are turning out to be in the East.
Well, Gretchen Bakke, one thing we have not talked about is conservation, which is huge. I mean, as you point out in this book, in spite of the fact that we have, billions of more electronic devices, many, many more people than the 1970s, we're using no more electricity than that. And yet still, it's a great untapped resource in many ways, the classic low-hanging fruit of efficiency. Talk a little bit about where we can go with conservation.
Yeah, that's the big social change. And it's not just the idea that you turn your lights down or off when you go to bed. It's the idea that we as consumers respond to the structures of electricity production. And that means often something like deployable efficiency, but the way that the grid was built to work, and this is why I say the 20th century models just don't function essentially with these variable renewables, because the way the grid was built to work was this: we make as much power on the supply side as anybody would ever want to use on the demand side. And what we have to change now is to say, the demand side needs to be able to be flexible as well. We need to be able to control how much electricity people are using and when they're using it without privation. And that, again, is different from the 70s. Nobody's really saying put on a sweater, you know. But how can there be a flexible, often computerized control of the electricity that's being used in any given moment that then links backwards to the electricity that's being produced in any given moment? And one of the ways to do that is with sort of massive computerization. And some, at a very minor level, some of these things are already happening where you can, for example, opt in if you have air conditioning and your utility will give you $40 for the summer, and then they can control how cold the inside of your house is, depending on how much electricity they have available. Mm-hmm. Ideally, not in a way you would ever notice. Or office buildings, for example, to be able to turn down the lighting in every room that isn't occupied, and you have some sort of eye that just determines that, and that can just be done automatically. So how is it that how much electricity that we give over in some way control of how much electricity we use at any given moment to some kind of entity? It might be just to the dishwasher or it might be to the utility. And there's a lot of question. That's where the utility death spiral comes into it, because people don't like their utilities and they don't trust their utilities. But the idea that you can have a deployable conservation, so as needed, things can turn down. Or as needed, if there's too much electricity, for example, at noon, from all of these solar panels which are shooting way too much electricity out into the grid, you have a hot water heater that heats up all your hot water for the day right then and effectively is storing it. It's taking electricity and it's making it into hot water, which you will then use later in the day. This is a vast world of possibility, and we're just beginning to go there because people don't want their stuff, their power, meddled with. They're afraid that what's going to happen is that their air conditioning is going to turn off and they're going to be sweltering.
Or the government will turn it off if they don't like you.
Or the government will turn it off. The intervention, the shift of mind from I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, and I'm going to be able to afford it because it's the price is fair, shifting that over to I'm going to let this very, very essential part of my life be controlled by another kind of entity, it's shocking. And I think that in the book, the place where you see it most clearly is with the fight over smart meters. Mm-hmm. But every time there's an intervention that gets into people's lives at this very intimate level, there's a lot of pushback. And so, of course, corporations, big buildings, casinos, manufactories, these are the places that are sort of opting in. And then prisons and high schools, like sort of places where the people who are in it can't complain. You know, there's sort of a powerlessness to the occupants of the space. And so those often also get taken up as part of this demand response or a deployable conservation. But as the Internet of Things, as we call it, comes into being, and it is in fact coming, and as the energy cloud, which is sort of a new popular idea, comes into being, which basically takes account for the variability of electricity going in and also balances with the variability, the way that we use, or that electricity is used, maybe not us, but that electricity is used, as all of that comes to be, and it is coming to be, and that's sort of the ways in which the grid is shifting into the future.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with cultural anthropologist Gretchen Bakke about her book, The Grid. But, you know, one of the things I also appreciate in your book is not only a discussion of this, but a discussion of how to actually empower people. You mentioned a few of these, but I can imagine using the technologies of the past, for example, to lower our needs for electricity, not to deprive ourselves, but by just smarter design. For example, there's an ice box you mentioned, and then I looked it up. You know, an ice box instead of an air conditioner.
It's a brilliant design, which is that it's a machine that makes ice during the night when electricity is cheap, and then during the day it just blows a fan on that ice and it melts.
Exactly, and also ways in which, you know, with microgrids or nanogrids, that people can assert more power over their power. You know, it's not just that a smart grid or a smart meter means that we have to give up our power to somebody else, but maybe we might be able to get some power back because of it as well.
Yeah, and I think that especially with nanogrids, the people who are interested, which is not everybody in the least, but the people who are interested, they learn very quickly about how electricity works in their home, and they make decisions to make those systems work better. So there's sort of a built-in educational piece of being a nanogrid, or even of putting solar panels up and understanding how much you use and how much the different things, you know, how much you make, how much you use. There's a lot of spaces we could go. For example, refrigerators, they were designed to be very greedy electric machines very early on because the utilities needed some way to use nighttime electricity. So anything in your house that you look at that uses electricity at night, you can guess that in the 1940s and 1950s, they were pushed hard by the utilities to get them into everybody's house. And refrigerators have become far, far more efficient, but they can also run on gas. It's a different design, but it was the most popular design way back in the beginning. There was a lot of competition between the electric fridge and the gas fridge. And gas fridges are quiet, which people also tend to like. So there's a lot of ways in which usage can be shifted, and you know, machines already are becoming more efficient.
Well, we could go on and on. This is just a fascinating book, The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. And it's been fascinating to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for the great questions and just for initiating the conversation.
Gretchen Bakke is Assistant Professor of Anthropology at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. Her book, The Grid, is published by Bloomsbury. Trump claims the 2016 presidential election will be rigged. He promotes the specter of voter fraud, something that's so rare as to be practically non-existent in actual fact. But there are other ways of rigging an election. Some are through the kinds of voter suppression pushed by Trump and the Republican Party, purging legitimate voters from the rolls, requiring onerous IDs to vote, and closing polling places. And then there's the manipulation of the vote through rigging electronic voting machines or changing the results when the votes are tabulated. Both parties may be practitioners of that. We've spoken before with journalist Lulu Freisdat about her report, An Electoral System in Crisis, that examines statistical anomalies in the 2016 presidential primaries. This week, we spoke with her about troubling findings in her new report on the Florida Democratic primary between Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Tim Canova. We don't have time to air it, but you can find it at our website, writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.